Okay, how bad could it get? Blowing the debt limit, I mean. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday, today the 29th of September. Good as always to have you along. Everybody, the short answer to the question just posed, how bad could it get, is pretty bad.
If this debt limit binds and if it lasts, we will get a recession.
That's Louise Shaner. She's senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and we called her because of this.
That's the weird thing. It's just politics. It's not an economic issue. It's a political issue.
Specifically, Republicans standing in the way of letting Treasury borrow money to pay the bills that Congress has already run up. That much is on the record. What happens, though, the day after we blow the debt limit, which is, at the moment, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen says, October the 18th.
They had a playbook in 2011 when we were at a similar situation. And what they decided to do then is that they would continue to make interest and principal payments. And so not technically default on securities.
Of course, you can't borrow more money. What are you going to do?
What they decided to do would be to sort of reduce the payments to everybody else who they typically pay.
Like?
Health providers through Medicare. It means Social Security beneficiaries, federal employees.
Choices you got to make because
nobody wants to undermine the Treasury market, right? It is the crucial financial market in the entire world. And the cost of not making a payment could be quite catastrophic.
How catastrophic? Well, as it happens, Shaner says, Moody's just did some analysis.
If the impasse lasted through November, they said that employment would decline by 5 million jobs and real GDP would decline almost 4% in the near term, and it would recover, but it would take a few quarters to recover.
So if you wonder why we keep talking about the debt limit, that's why. Will the Democrats eventually get an increase passed by themselves? Probably. Is all of this unnecessarily risky? Definitely. Did Wall Street care today? Not a single little bit. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Sherwin-Williams, the paint people, lowered their sales and earnings expectations yesterday. It seems there is a shortage of paint. Thank you, supply chain. So we called Ryan Amato. He is the proprietor of Ryan Amato Painting in Easton, Pennsylvania. And we asked him, basically, paint shortages? Really?
Well, we've been hearing about it for well over a year. And then the pandemic hit. So that was an issue. Yeah. There's been obviously a labor shortage, so the truck drivers delivering the paint, that's been an issue. There was the freeze down in Texas, and they supply a good amount of the resins, which is an ingredient for all the paints that we use.
Yeah, so it's a chemicals heavy process, right?
Absolutely. It's an ingredient just like you bake a cake. It's one of our main ingredients in the paint, and we've had a major shortage of it.
So what are you doing?
Well, I like to think that we're well prepared at my company. So we have great suppliers and vendors. Unfortunately, if you came to our shop, I'm looking at about 500 gallons of untinted paint sitting on pallets. Just so we're prepared for our customers, we're ordering in very large quantities of paint.
The catch, of course, is that untinted paint is no good if I need to paint my house blue, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And there are so many different bases of paint. So if you need a dark blue, it's a different base than white. Hmm. So we're trying to do the best we can to stay prepared for you, for the customer.
All right, so let's make it about me. I do, in point of fact, actually need to have my house painted. How much of a lead time do I need to give you before you can say, yep, I'll be there on Thursday?
That's a great question, and it's been a struggle. So historically in our business, when we win a job, your job, we send you over a color sheet that you have to fill out.
Yeah.
Normally not a big deal. Give it to us a week or two before the project starts, and that's typically in about 4 to 6 weeks. Now we're really twisting your arm behind your back that as soon as you accept that job, we need that color sheet within a day or two after your job is accepted. So we need about 2 or 3 weeks to make sure that we have the proper materials for your project.
And I imagine, Mr. Amato, it's going to cost me more too, right?
It's certainly going to cost you more. We've seen it's been about 20% since really only about 4 or 5 months ago, and 40% increase in our epoxy floors, which is pretty significant.
So I imagine you've got a go-to supplier, right? But is this one of those where you could find another source and try to do it that way? I'm sure you thought of that.
And that's what we've been doing. Yeah. What the only problem with that is, and there's many different suppliers, and we all know them. However, paint is not all the same. You can't just grab 1 gallon of paint and go to another vendor and grab another gallon of paint, and it performs the same way. So not only are we seeing issues with we're using now paints we haven't used before, it has also slowed down our production, our labor, because they're using new paints. It requires different paintbrushes. They all perform differently. It's been a learning curve all around, not even to mention just the shortage of materials.
That's kind of wild that paint is not paint is not paint. It's all different.
Absolutely.
How long have you been in the painting business, Mr. Romano?
I've been in the painting business 30 years. I hate to say that now. I feel like I'm getting older.
Tell me about it. You ever seen anything like this?
No, never. The only other issue we had was it's always been labor. You know, we had some issues after 9/11 with labor and the amount of jobs. This has been very difficult.
Ryan Amato, he runs his own company. It's called Ryan Amato Painting out of Easton, Pennsylvania. Mr. Amato, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you very much.
There's a new ticker symbol to tell you about that might be of interest to some. WRBY is the ticker, started trading today. Warby Parker, the eyewear company, one of the early direct-to-consumer online brands, but also now brick-and-mortar as well. One of the key factors in its fortunes? Well, the pandemic. Marketplace's Caroline Champlin reports.
Just before the pandemic in 2019, most Warby Parker revenue was coming from in-person sales. Then in 2020, thanks to lockdowns, that flipped and online sales boomed. Now it's about 50-50, and hybrid shoppers are who you want, says Melissa Gonzalez, CEO of Lioness Group.
They're usually spending more per visit. They're returning products less frequently. They're repurchasing more often because they've developed this next level of confidence.
Warby Parker is feeling confident too and plans to keep expanding in-person locations. But Forrester analyst Sucharita Kadali says that's risky, given how the pandemic shut down retail stores, including all 150 of Warby Parker's.
Half of the retail world thinks that they will go back to where they were, and the other half believes that the store is doomed.
Plus, Kadali says Warby Parker has inspired their own competition, and future company leaders will have to contend with that.
What they are going to inherit is a brand that is a nice brand, but a brand in an incredibly challenged space with a really fickle customer.
She says the direct-to-consumer customers are often younger and not particularly brand loyal. On top of that, the now public company has a bigger profile to maintain. I'm Caroline Champlin for Marketplace.
There was news from Berlin this week, not the big who gets to replace Angela Merkel election, but a vote by residents of the German capital that would allow the seizure of rental properties from the biggest corporate landlords in the city and turn them into public housing. The measure is non-binding, and of course, as goes Berlin, so do not always go places on these shores. But there is plenty of concern over here about the growing influence of big corporate landlords in this housing market. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
Most rental units in the U.S. are under some sort of corporate ownership that spans from individuals with an LLC up to giant real estate magnates with hundreds or thousands of units, says Jenny Schutz with the Brookings Institution. What worries most people, she says, is the increase of private equity money in the housing market from Wall Street firms like BlackRock.
So they're more likely either to buy something that's going to have quick appreciation and sell it, or something that's going to have higher than usual returns.
The trend goes back to the Great Recession, when investment firms started scooping up distressed properties for bargain basement rates, says Dan Immergluck, an urban studies professor at Georgia State.
In some suburban neighborhoods, the share of the largest private equity firms is often 10, 15, 20%.
That's driven up prices for average home buyers, and it poses challenges for renters, says Jim Baker with the Private Equity Stakeholder Project.
It comes with being aggressive at raising rents, being aggressive about eviction practices.
He says the complicated business ownership structures make it difficult for tenants to respond.
It's almost mechanical. They just automatically file, you know, in some cases, hundreds of eviction filings.
Andy says the hot pandemic housing market has left many smaller landlords looking to sell at top dollar. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Coming up.
From any building on the planet.
Big Brother is watching your carbon emissions. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 90 today, 90 points, 0.2%, closed at 34,390. The NASDAQ got rid of 34 points, about 0.2%, ended at 14,512. S&P 500 up 0.6%, 43.59. Dollar Tree shot up 16.4% after the discount retailer announced it plans to sell more items priced above $1, which I don't understand how that works. Do they have to be like above a Dollar Tree now? I don't know. Rival Dollar General marched up 0.8%. AutoNation picked up more than 5% today after Morgan Stanley upgraded the stock. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note down just a touch. Still a relatively high for recent days, 1.52% on the 10-year. You're listening to Marketplace.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns, meaning when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal, rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Part of the conversation I had yesterday with Indra Nooyi, the former CEO of PepsiCo, was about childcare and women, because it's almost entirely women who bear that burden, about women not being able to work if they don't have childcare. And that leads me to Chibeli Karazana. She covers the economy for the 19th, most recently, the child tax credit and who is not getting it. Chibeli, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much.
Do me a favor, would you, and for those who aren't familiar or because it's confusing sometimes, what exactly is the child tax credit?
Sure. So the child tax credit is a direct payment that families with children have been receiving every year with their taxes. The big difference in the past year has been that three fundamental pieces of the child tax credit were altered. So previously, families were getting about $2,000. Now you can receive as much as $3,600 per child. The other big difference is you were receiving this money annually. You are now receiving it monthly. As of July 15th, families started to receive it every month for the rest of this year. And then the third big piece is that this money is fully available to the lowest income families in the country. Now, before, those families were limited to only receive a portion of the child tax credit. Now they are receiving the entire thing. So if you don't pay anything in taxes, you can get this credit. If you are undocumented, but your child is a U.S. citizen, you get this credit. And so that is sort of the big promise of the child tax credit from the past year.
Right. Emphasis on the word promise, because as your piece points out, that is not actually what's happening, that third slice of you know, the plan.
Well, promise and access are two different things, right? And yes. We're seeing that very sort of viscerally this year, where we have certain groups that are continuously left out and left out as every month progresses. Sometimes we know why and sometimes we don't.
So give me an example. There's a bunch in your story. Pick your favorite anecdote.
Sure. So undocumented families, we have spoken to a number of them that have told us, you know, we are still not receiving this money and we don't know why. And you go with them point by point on all of the qualifications that you need to receive this money. And it seems like they qualify. And the IRS can't necessarily tell us why this is happening. It might be individualized to each person. But we know already from the beginning of this rollout in July that families that had one undocumented person did not receive the credit at all when it initially started to go out. They started to correct that in the following months, but we know that there have been continuing problems month to month. You're going to get monthly payments until December. And so if your status isn't cleared by then, you're not going to, you know, be able to share in this promise of, you know, we're going to get this money to you monthly because there is a need right now during the pandemic. And these are the most vulnerable people.
Well, so let's contextualize this a little bit, right? Latinos, who are, you know, the preponderance of the people you're talking about in your piece, they're among the most unemployed group of people in the past 18 months in this economy, right? So in theory, that's where the need is, and yet the aid's not getting there.
Oh, Latinas in particular. I mean, Latinas as a group had the highest unemployment rate of any in the past year and a half, topping 20% last summer. You know, I had one mom tell me, I would use this for the $85 in school supplies that I need to buy for my two kids, for rent, for to keep the light on, to keep the Wi-Fi. Those are the folks that we know need it the most, and also the people who have to jump the most hurdles in order to get it.
So where does this go? I mean, the IRS says, I don't know. And the people with whom you have been speaking say, listen, we need this money for school supplies and diapers and food and what have you. Where do we go?
Well, I think kind of the big structural problem here is the IRS is under a lot of stress this year. They need more funding to be able to do something this enormous. The need that these families have is not just for the year that this child tax credit has been expanded, but it's going to be a need that's going to continue on. And so right now in Congress, that's what's being debated. Are we going to make the child tax credit permanent? Because the need very clearly is not going away.
Jabeli Carzana, she writes for the 19th about a bunch of stuff, most particularly now, the child tax credit and these payments. Jabeli, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks so much.
There was a sweet spot in this pandemic when people were getting out and about again, going shopping or going to the office or whatever, but traffic was still reasonably not so bad. Those days, for city dwellers at least, are long gone and traffic's as bad as it ever was, which helps explain why New York City has started holding public hearings on congestion pricing for drivers wanting to enter the busiest, most traffic-jammed parts of Manhattan. It'd be a first for this country, but congestion pricing is already a thing globally, as Marketplace's Sabri Benishol reports.
New Yorkers are making their feelings known about congestion pricing.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Can you hear me?
Hearings were held on Zoom.
New York City needs to embrace congestion pricing.
I just want to say I'm disgusted with this whole thing.
That's Sheila Shapiro and Patrick Johnson testifying there. Congestion pricing is like, imagine a toll road, but it's a whole part of a city. London, Singapore, and Stockholm already have these tolls. Here's what we know from their experience.
They work.
Matthew Turner is professor of economics at Brown. London reduced delay time due to traffic by 30%. Singapore's downtown traffic whizzes around freely, says Turner.
speed is really sensitive to the number of people on the road. So if you get a small number of people to leave the highway at peak times, it has a big effect on travel speeds.
Of course, that small number of people getting off the roads could turn out to be the lowest income people.
Basically, that's the number one concern.
Lewis Lee is assistant professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of Illinois. He says the same income problems exist with charging for parking or a gas tax, but we still have those.
You should also think of the people who are on buses, which are greatly slowed down and less reliable because of the heavy traffic.
New York plans to use the money it raises to improve public transit and to offer a tax credit for people making $60,000 or less. The review process lasts till 2023. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, gave, as all the leaders do, a speech at the United Nations General Assembly last week. Johnson, though, as is his style, was a little bit different, in particular in trying to drum up support for the big COP26 climate change meeting in Glasgow in November.
And when Kermit the Frog sang, "It's not easy being green." You remember that one? I want you to know that he was wrong. He was wrong. It is easy. It's not only easy, it's lucrative, and it's right to be green. Although he was also unnecessarily rude to Miss Piggy, I thought, Kermit the Frog.
I mean, he was right about Kermit and Miss Piggy, right? But Johnson's bigger point is right, too. It is easy and lucrative being green, in part because we have the technology to avoid catastrophic climate change, a message echoed by a British startup called Satellite View, which offers what it says are measurements of how individual companies and even households are doing in controlling their greenhouse gas emissions, kind of a thermal spy in the sky, as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from London.
Satellites have been spying on us for decades, but this one really is for the benefit of the whole planet. A satellite specifically designed to combat climate change through very precise thermal imaging.
Seeing the world through a different pair of eyes rather than through the optical lens, a thermal lens. What's hot and what's not?
Data analyst Jade Constantinou works for a British startup, Satellite View. The boss, Anthony Baker, is planning to launch a constellation of 7 satellites equipped with a very special camera.
The unique thing about our camera is it can image in infrared, so we can see the heat emissions from any building on the planet.
That's any building? Any individual building?
Yeah, our satellite covers the world and has a high enough resolution that you can discern one building from another.
Measuring heat loss and therefore energy efficiency will enable governments to identify the most wasteful carbon-polluting properties.
To be able to hone in on those worst-emitting buildings and direct people to do something about it.
And he says it'll test the current plethora of good environmental intentions.
Everyone is declaring net zero. At the moment, not many people are measuring anything.
The firm is expecting a wide range of customers, governments, environmental groups, insulation companies prospecting for business, and, says the sales director Alex Gao, investors anxious to verify a company's commitment to reducing emissions.
To identify and hold to account people who are claiming that they have green credentials.
This is a form of accountancy or auditing.
Absolutely, and more importantly, it's independent.
The service is surprisingly inexpensive, says Anthony Baker, since one thermal image covers around 6 square miles containing thousands of properties.
$500 is the cost of one image covering thousands of buildings, so the cost per building is very, very low.
So this will be affordable not only for governments and corporations, but inquisitive individuals too.
You can see the place you work, the place you shop, your street, so you could determine whether you're the worst building on the street.
You could even spy on your neighbours and find out whether they are as green as they say they are.
If people wish to remind their neighbours that they perhaps should upgrade their insulation, so be it.
Liftoff will start in T-minus 10 seconds.
His first satellite is due to be blasted into orbit next year by Elon Musk's company, SpaceX.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. We have ignition.
As the countdown to net zero continues, Baker expects his revenues to take off. Already he's had inquiries from every continent. Demand, he hopes, will, like his satellite, go global. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today from the Marketplace desk of About Time. The NCAA announced today that henceforth the phrase March Madness, the byword of its men's basketball tournament all these years, may also be used to describe the women's tournament as well. How about that? Like I said, about time. All right, we got to go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. The subhead on this one is the Delta variant is still in charge of this economy. The National Restaurant Association reports more than half of the restaurants it surveyed say business conditions are worse now than they were 3 months ago. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Liana Squillace, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torrado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.